one does happenstance upon a, let's say, non-ordinary experience, there is a natural gravitation and pull to kind of get back to things as they were, to sober up or get back into it, because our regular state of being is one that's maximally in pursuit of reducing uncertainty. We want to minimize surprise. Surprise is costly for us in our system. It changes our affect when things in the environment don't match our expectations. It doesn't feel as good. So we want to get it to a state of feeling good. And the best way to feel good is through comfort. And comfort is typically associated with things that reduce uncertainty. It's something very familiar to us. So that snap back is very common and understandable, and in a lot of ways, healthy. And I think the idea here is to not necessarily always dramatically uplift your life and totally change all of your plans. But how can we make subtle changes that actually stick and actually integrate into your everyday behavior and may actually get you out of some maladaptive thinking?
Welcome. Imagine for a moment that you and I take this metaphorical blender, and in it we combine an academic lab, you know, the kind you find at a university, and then add in a large dollop of entrepreneurial flexibility, the kind you might find at, say, a startup. It's a weird recipe, isn't it? What would it give you? It would certainly shift the criterion for deciding what's important, wouldn't it? But why might that matter to you and your reality? Well, our guest for the next two episodes is Professor Nico Regente. He and his team are spearheading a host of exciting projects on how to utilize non-ordinary states of consciousness. Now, if you're not sure what that means, we'll explain it, I promise. And how to do it to promote human flourishing. We're going to go where few podcasts have dared to go before. Welcome to the Dov Barron Show. Come for the stories, stay for the learning. I'm your host, Dov Barron. I advise high-performing organizations and leaders on how to harness their emotional source code to transform their tribe. Nico Regente, he's a research director at the Institute for Advanced Consciousness Studies. It's a nonprofit dedicated to democratizing non-ordinary states of consciousness. Now, what is that? We're going to get into it, but in a simplest form, think about an ordinary state of consciousness as you just walking around in an ordinary state. A dream state is a non-ordinary state of consciousness. It's not your ordinary way of thinking. Another way is some people do psychedelics, or they've had meditations, or they've had visualizations, and something has shifted. It's a non-ordinary. It's not ordinary. It's something different. His work has integrated meditation, aesthetic chills, and something referred to as technodelics, not psychedelics, technodelics, with neuroimaging, neurofeedback, and machine learning techniques to cultivate personalized experiences that promote well-being and facilitate adaptive belief updating. We're going to get into that too. His past work has included enriching human memory with virtual reality, as well as predicting treatment trajectories with prognostic neuroimaging. Nico also lectures on functional neuroimaging at his alma mater, UCLA. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of every kind, turn up the volume and help me to welcome Professor Nico Regente.
Thank you, Dov. That was a wonderful intro. I really appreciate your context. Yeah.
You're so welcome, mate. Like I said, I've been really looking forward to this conversation. When you and I had our first conversation, it was like, oh, this guy and I are so speaking on the same wavelength. But you're in it from a very different point of view than me. I mean, you dive into it at a really deep scientific level. And I can imagine that that is pretty all-consuming. I'm not in a lab. I know it's all-consuming for me. I imagine it's pretty all-consuming. You live in California?
Yep. I ride my one-wheel into the lab, which is in Santa Monica, and I'm just a few blocks away.
You're one-wheeler, one of those maniacs on a one-wheeler. I see them in the streets here all the time. Not saying you, but they ignore all traffic signs, cut people off, and I'm like, how are you not dead?
The board affords you such capabilities that I'm sure that it leads to errant behavior here and there. But seriously, I think it's one of the most well-designed pieces of machinery ever. So,
really?
Yeah, yeah.
Were you a skateboarder?
Longboarder more so, yeah. So I did a lot of longboarding and surfing, and so I picked it up pretty quickly. But it's a crazy learning curve.
I'm sure it is. I can't even imagine how that is. So in the introduction, I talked about what you're doing is adding entrepreneurial flexibility to, like, startup lab to academic. Tell us a little bit about that, because that doesn't make sense on the surface, because one, it seems to be very rigid, and the other one seems to be very open to all ideas.
So I think it's important to take a quick perspective of most people that go into a PhD program, and when they come out, they're kind of faced with this choice, right? You can ask almost anyone that's got a PhD, do I go into academia or do I go into academia is a bit more in alignment with what actually got you going in the first place. It's typically some form of scientific or STEM-based interest that you really needed to dive deep into because you couldn't find the questions out there, so you needed to go do it yourself. And PhD is very much so a labor of love. And so going back to academia would be particularly continuing to pursue those efforts, doing science to contribute to the corpus and proliferating that knowledge within the academic community. Whereas on the industry side, very well paying and typically a little bit divorced from what you actually went to go do. A whole host of psychology PhDs or neuroscience PhDs are now doing data analysis for marketing campaigns at large companies that kind of want the three letters after their last name to add to their roster, as well as kind of get their chops that they gained along the way, like data analytical skills. In a lot of ways, it's kind of like, okay, well, after a PhD, do I go and complete my pursuit of my intellectual pursuits, but then also kind of suffer with a lot of bureaucracy, heavy competition, relocation? Or do you go into industry where you're a little bit divorced from what you wanted to do, but the pay is high and a lot more flexibility? So when I was in that position, I thought to myself, there has to be a better way. There has to be a third path, a middle path, where you can take the rigor and the beauty of the scientific method that's employed by academia, as well as the boots on the ground, making real world change, disrupting things, building and proliferating the proceedings of your scientific insights, not just to the academic community, but to the broader populace. So that's kind of why I started in the first place. And I always say it's the biggest experiment we're running, the existence of the place itself, as this nonprofit research endeavor that's hyper-focused on doing good, solid, rigorous science that's going to be published in high-impact peer-reviewed journals, but also working with companies and tools and ideas that are outside of the traditional ivory tower jurisdiction and be able to rapidly translate those findings into things that actually go on to help promote human flourishing.
I read that at the beginning. I read that out about the work is around human flourishing through non-ordinary states of consciousness. So put that into context for the sort of person on the street who is, first of all, not sure what it means to be non-ordinary states of consciousness. And what does it mean when you say flourishing? I think that that's a very misunderstood term because people look at being happier, but that's not necessarily the same as flourishing. So walk us a little bit through that, if you could.
Yeah, so let's start with flourishing. So I think flourishing comes from the perspective of not just surviving, but thriving. If you think a bit about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, this would be things more towards the top of that pyramid where you can be engaging, where you have the freedom and ability to be engaging in activities that are closer to self-actualization, bringing you into alignment with what you truly feel called to. So that'd be like kind of the peak of flourishing.
Yep.
Coming back down, it's not like a specific experience is necessarily going to alleviate you from poverty, let's say. However, it might inspire you to get into specific patterns of behavior that eventually lead to that. But that's not really what we're focused on here. We're really focused on how do we promote your mental health and social cohesion in a way that serves you and promotes well-being. Well-being being the state of feeling good, feeling well, and feeling in alignment and feeling fulfilled. And as if you have a goal that's possible of being met and that you also feel some notion of present moment awareness as well, that you're not constantly striving towards things. There is a goal, but that you're also happy where you are. So human flourishing kind of falls in that perspective, and it is more so of a collective measure. And we can get into it later, but a lot of the things we focus on around human flourishing is actually focused on helping to promote empathic concern. How can you both empathize with an individual and then actually care about the fact that you are harboring their feeling? Because if you can uptick empathic concern in an individual, you're not just helping them, you're helping now everybody that they come into contact with. So this is more of a collective human flourishing by upregulating traits within it. Now, the non-ordinary experiences aspect and how we're utilizing those. So non-ordinary states of consciousness. This is very often debated about whether or not to call it non-ordinary states or altered states. I'm in the camp that believes we should use the nomers of non-ordinary states because you could almost argue that every state is an altered state of consciousness and there is no regular steady state. But there are some states that are more ordinary or within a set. Like even having this interview, I would argue, is a more ordinary state of consciousness, or me showing up to work and being sober and awake and aware and in work mode. It's pretty ordinary. Tripping on a couple hundred micrograms of LSD, not as ordinary, also quite altered. So that's the idea, is if there is a normal distribution, let's say, of potential subjective experiences or qualia, and if that distribution is built upon the amount of time ordinarily spent in those states, we're focused on those states that are outside of that distribution, on the tails of the distribution, that would be non-ordinary, not happening as every aspect of your daily life. You can't even actually do LSD every day.
Do you think that people notice that? Because you're talking about ordinary states and non-ordinary. Because I'm old enough, we used to always call them altered states. But I think that a lot of time, as Richard Bandler said, our job is not getting people into a trance, it's getting them out of the trance they're in. And so I don't know that people notice so much. They veer back to normal so quickly because it feels like, oh, what's going on? We're not talking about having taken LSD or mushrooms or anything else you might have done, but it's like this clinging to the ordinary. That's what I find interesting about your work, is that you're working in helping people to flourish by embracing non-ordinary moments, but at the same time, human beings definitely cling to what's familiar. That's part of our psyche. It's part of our actually makeup, is to cling to what's familiar, and therefore we don't want to go there. I know there are people who do. I'm one of them. You're one of them. But as a general, because we're talking about flourishing as a planetary embodiment of population, how do you deal with that? Because I know you deal with this sort of upgrading people's beliefs. So that's another factor of this.
That's a great point. I mean, you briefly said it, but there's an overarching elephant here, which is, what is ordinary? Is it ordinary to be subscribed to the Maya illusion in the first place? Is that the matrix of it being ordinary that I'm going to work today or signing into a computer? So I think we need to kind of, at least for the purposes of this discussion, operate within that mainframe, if you will, operate within that matrix. But it's important to acknowledge that the whole thing may be in the first place. If one does happenstance upon a, let's say, non-ordinary experience, there is a natural gravitation and pull to kind of get back to things as they were, to sober up or get back into it, because our regular state of being is one that's maximally in pursuit of reducing uncertainty. We want to minimize surprise. Surprise is costly for us in our system. It changes our affect when things in the environment don't match our expectations. It doesn't feel as good. So we want to get it to a state of feeling good. And the best way to feel good is through comfort. And comfort is typically associated with things that reduce uncertainty. It's something very familiar to us. So that snap back is very common and understandable, and in a lot of ways, healthy. And I think the idea here is to not necessarily always dramatically uplift your life and totally change all of your plans. But how can we make subtle changes that actually stick and actually integrate into your everyday behavior and may actually get you out of some maladaptive thinking, this whole notion of canalization and getting too rigid in your belief structure? How can we get you out of that, or at least provide you with opportunities and perspectives that permit for you to see that there's other ways? The idea is, okay, oftentimes it's a happenstance, these non-ordinary experiences. Sometimes it's intentional. You're going to take a trip. Sometimes just the right constellation of events hit you and it induces some form of insight that you may forget the next day because you've gravitated back to your routine as usual. Well, how can we find a way to more programmatically guide you to such experiences and then also offer you handholding after the fact to then integrate that into your life so that it's not just something that happened that you say was weird or, oh, that was trippy or cool. It's actually, you've been able to orient it and digest it and understand it and integrate into your belief structures to then go on to downregulate beliefs that aren't serving you and are actually gating your capacity for well-being. So we can get into that a lot more because I think it'll make sense.
That brings up a couple of things. First of all, that brings up for me, at least, from my clients and the work that I've done over the years. First of all, most people are fairly unconscious about shitty belief systems. That's number one. Then let's say they become aware of those belief systems. And I used to do a lot of belief dismantling about 30 years ago and realized it was a waste of time. It didn't matter. because the beliefs and values are built on the identity that person has. And they're sure as hell not giving up that identity in a hurry because they've survived based on that identity. And that identity is based on a meaning that they've given to their life, that life is shit or dangerous or it's easy and free, whatever it might be. There's an identity and there's a meaning given to that. People say to me, I knew this was a bad guy, or I knew this was a bad person. Why did I stay in it? And my answer is, what was familiar about it? And they go, well, you know, I didn't see it at first, but then I realized it was a lot like my abusive or narcissistic parent or, you know, whatever it was. And I'm like, yeah, it's familiar. We are so attracted to the familiar, even if the familiar is shit. So even that person who has an awareness that this is familiar doesn't necessarily want to examine the belief that makes the familiar so attractive. How is your work interacting with that kind of mentality? People are not, quote, sick. They're not something wrong with them. It's actually part of the normal operating system. And then there's a glimpse, there's this crack in the wall that, oh, yeah, this is me. I'm doing this. How do you and your work directly deal with that?
I love that. That's great. Yeah, you're really touching on an important point, which is that when we say maladaptive beliefs, they're only maladaptive in the current context. They probably originated because they were adaptive in the moment. So if you've crystallized these beliefs, because oftentimes, unfortunately, it's from adverse childhood experiences, and you've adapted a set of beliefs that help you make sense of a world that may have been chaotic in some sense to you, or some circumstances. And now that belief that was adaptive, you may have now literally graduated out of that scenario. And now you're holding the same beliefs that in a different context are now maladaptive and may actually serve as a gravity of sorts to now attract new circumstances that are more like the old one, because then it makes your beliefs congruent. So that's something that can be going on in the background that you may not ever be explicitly aware of. And oftentimes it's hard to even suss it out, even through therapy, even through questionnaires. So what we focused on is, how do we just make you feel it when your beliefs are challenged, confronted, resolved in some capacity? How can we present you with an experience that is revelatory of your underlying belief? And then you actually feel it so that it's an orientation mechanism. You can't deny the feeling. So this is why many may not at face value really understand why we've turned to them, but hopefully it'll evolve through our conversation. This is why we've been using aesthetic chills as both a probe and promoter of well-being, much like how exercise is a probe and promoter of fitness. We think that chills actually are a great barometer on the weather of your internal self.
Before you go on, let me sort of bring everybody up today, because this was how you and I ended up in this conversation. The aesthetic chills, because for me, I have only met a few people who are like me, who have these moments where I go, ugh. Some people used to call it walking over their grave. My buddy used to say it was brain surgery. And what he meant by that was, you don't want to be a brain surgeon having one of those, because you're all wobbly. And I call them love surges. Right? And I've always called them love surges. It's this moment of like, whoa. And it seems spontaneous, but it's not always spontaneous. I've asked around and most people don't seem to either have them or recognize them, but you've used them as a sort of scientific barometer. That for me was really interesting. And you're talking about how this is a really great barometer. If people are not aware of having them, or maybe are not having, how do we use that?
Yeah, so typically the types of chills that we're talking about, it's almost characterized by a state of being impossible to ignore. You have to notice it. So it may not happen frequently to you. In your case, it does.
I'm a weirdo.
It may not happen frequently, but when it does happen, that's actually one of the hallmarks of the state itself, is that it's hyper salient and noticeable. The phenomenology accompanying it is quite non-ordinary, which we can get into a bit later. But chills specifically, many cultures refer to them by different names. There's no actual name for the phenomenon and the phenomenology itself. It's kind of defined by its shadow of things. Like frisson in French means shivers. So that's when you actually get the shivers, right? You can get shivers from many different. This is why we use the term aesthetic chills. It's also usually complemented by a physiological response. So a lot of people get goosebumps all over their skin. And in indigenous Mexican cultures, they call this chicken skin. Very interesting way of denoting that someone is going the right way or having some kind of mystical experience. There's definitely some precedent here of being able to use chills as information. So it's really characterized by this intense affect that includes this recruitment of goosebumps and shivers, things that, you know, very interestingly, are some of the most important things our body does in thermoregulation. The fact that you shiver to change metabolic processes and do heat sinks, et cetera. Same thing with goosebumps. It's changing the surface area for different heat dissipation. It's actually making you seem larger as a threat to other animals. There's a whole host of different evolutionary principles behind the chills. And it's very interesting that such an important system can be recruited by something that's almost predominantly semantic or cognitive in nature. So the chills as a phenomenon, I just want to point out, is hyper salient. And when we talk about chills, we're talking about the types of things you wouldn't be able to in this case.
So for me, in my own case, I mean, it's literally a full sort of body. But how did you come into it? It seems pretty unusual. So how did you come into it? Was it something you were experiencing yourself, or was it something you suddenly started to notice? As we talked about before, it seems like a very unusual path to take.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. My buddy in college and I, he's a filmmaker. We used to always joke that chills are the point of life. And we kind of like knew what we were saying, but it was more of a stoner type statement, right? It was an orienting mechanism of sorts. And it wasn't until I met Dr. Felix Scholler, who's now become a fantastic collaborator. He's a senior scientist here at the Institute. He's running the Experiential Medicine Lab here at the Institute. And it wasn't until I met him and learned about some of his work that he's been doing for the past decade, where I really realized that chills represent this kind of peak in a learning rate. If we're always trying to learn and reduce uncertainty, minimize surprise in the environment, chills could be characterized, at least certain types of semantic-based insight chills, can be thought of as a way of having your learning rate reach a null derivative, or effectively saying your learning has kind of peaked. The final pieces of the puzzle came in and all of the model now is complete, and you've accounted for such a larger swath of the variance that was previously unanswered because now you got this final piece. And it's almost as though the chills are then what it feels like to have the propagation of belief updating travel, not just in the central nervous, but through the entire nervous, through the peripheral nervous, a full body alignment into orienting and recognizing that, hey, now things make more sense. Or, hey, this thing was important to you and you've had a model for it and now things make more sense. It plays a lot into the whole body keeps the score, psychosomatics of the body holding beliefs, even if they may be unconscious. When Felix had that type of perspective on that chills aren't just some random occurrence that happens here and it's like, oh, it's just all and it's just affect, that there may actually be meaning and belief attached to it, that this started to really click. And it was the intersection of both mine and Felix's work, like all of my background in personalized neuroscience and machine learning, that brought us together to start down this avenue of generating personalized chills content with therapeutic, which we can certainly get into.
So with intent, this is the interesting thing, because this is when it's therapeutic. This is when it's like, okay, so I'm listening to this and this guy's really interested and I'm finding it fascinating, but what do I do with this? I'm Joe Blow, the CEO of Schwingelsprungel XYZ Inc. What do I do with this? How do I integrate this in some simple form for myself? Where would you sort of guide the person to start?
It's a really cool set of things that you said there around this notion of information compression into something like an insight. How do we take all of these things that are floating around and distill it into one updating or one action item that I'm going to take? We actually think, I was talking about before, that learning rate null derivative, that chills could actually be a moment of information compression where insight happens and things make sense and you don't need as much detail to get it. You get the point. To your point, where would we put someone or how do we guide them? So just let me take a quick step back to describe why we think that chills are illustrative of internally held beliefs, and then why that matters for matching you to pieces of content that can elicit chills. Most of the time when we're navigating about our life, we were constantly making predictions to reduce uncertainty around the environment. This is kind of championed by the folks of the free energy principle and active inference, that every moment is another chance to try and take action that reduces uncertainty about what our model of those actions our brain would have cascaded out as. So most of the time, we're pretty good. If I go and I, you know, reach for this mug, it's going to kind of feel the way I'm anticipating, the way my grip around it touches it in a way that's pretty right. And that's the case for most things. It's kind of rare for us to be maximally wrong or maximally right. And you can kind of see the way in which your priors or your beliefs will kind of fill in information to reduce uncertainty in ambiguous situations. And you can see the ways in which this can pan out negatively for some people. Let's say you carry around a shame schema. You're filled with shame. Everything you do, there's a hint of wondering if you're going to be shamed for. You could interpret two people that you can't hear having a conversation and maybe looking over at you and laughing and giggling that they're making fun of you, or they're poking fun of you, or there's something you did that you should be ashamed of. That could be illustrative of an underlying shame schema, the way in which you reside in, to borrow a term from the Tiny Blue Dot Foundation, the way in which you reside inside of your perception box has a wallpapering around it that has some shame context. So it's filtering the way in which you see. Now, let's think a bit about watching a movie or engaging with just a short piece of YouTube content. Now, I watched that video and, oh yeah, it's kind of cool. Great. Not telling me anything new. It's cute. Maybe nice to look at. Whereas another person may have a full body chills experience from that piece of content. So why is one person getting chills and the other person not? Of course, there can be a whole host of your state, affect, and how you respond to the scenario. But after kind of going through a lot of that background noise, there could be something that's very revealing around the narrative structure in that content that's revelatory of your belief system. And it actually went in and confronted and maybe resolved those beliefs, challenged those beliefs in ways that were undeniable to you that you now have to update your system. It can't be right if you're going to bring in this new piece of evidence. So in that way, the response to a piece of audiovisual stimuli can be revelatory of the types of beliefs that someone holds. So if a piece of content is specifically talking or resolving a conflict around shame, and I don't have a shame schema, I may not resonate with that as much as someone who would. So in our work, and now kind of getting to your point, in our work, what we've been able to do is start operationalizing that process, start getting to know people a bit better through conversation, through some questionnaires, through watching some videos, and get to know a person so that we can then match them to a piece of content that is maximally likely to give them chills. And that's why before we were saying it's kind of using chills as a probe, saying like, oh, did you get chills from this? Oh, well, then maybe you have the schema. And now we're saying, okay, well, can we use it as a promoter of well-being? So can we then, after figuring out what type of schema you may have, can we now direct using machine learning to a piece of content that's maximally likely to give you chills in the context of the schema that you're carrying, so that now you have this full body pleasurable experience that's also resonating with the content to be had there? And that's where we've done a lot of work, is actually saying that chills is serving as a therapy.
There's chills as a measure of recognition, recognizing oneself in it, whether it's a belief system or whatever it might be, maybe a deep, and again, forgive me if I'm jumping ahead or if I'm wrong, please correct me, but a deep sense of direct empathy with whatever you're seeing. You feel a complete alignment with that. And then also chills as this, not a recognition, but a place to go. It's like, oh, that's what I'm searching for. That's what I've been after. This moment of seeing a movie that isn't your story, but there's an element of it that is just like, oh my God, that's me, even though it's not about me. And or as the other side of it, which is, oh my God, that's what I'm aspiring to. But I think that's what happened with the movie The Matrix. People sense this sense of like, something's off, and there's something like we're being manipulated somehow. And here's this beautifully manufactured version of what that might be, even though it's probably not it, but that validation of there's some shit going on where I'm being manipulated that gave people chills. And they went, what is this? And it wasn't necessarily a solution, although it was a solution in a conspiracy way for a lot of people. So there's two sides of it. Have I got that right?
Yeah. And that's fantastic. Like I was saying, like, it's very rare for your world model to be completely right. Most of the time it's kind of right. There's like this background, almost knowing of something that you can't pinpoint. And when something hits that nerve and pinpoints it directly, it's almost as though your model gets updated to a point where it can then capture so much more and then be super right. And when it's super right like that is when we think that you start to feel the chills. And with something like The Matrix, and we can start digging into this maybe in the next part, it's almost as though it's following something like what Plato called anamnesis, which is the unforgetting. It's something that we knew and forgot, and now we're unforgetting it and re-remembering. And something akin to the Matrix, where there is this simulacra and simulation, a great text that the Wachowskis actually made everybody on set read. We know that there's some representational system here to our perception, something that people like Anil Seth talk about, like this controlled hallucination, or Donald Hoffman, this like fitness beating truth. We know that there's a representation here. It's just consensus reality, right? There's not actual reality. And when something we know, but is typically ineffable. So when something like a great piece of work puts that into a tangible form that we can pinpoint and say, oh, that's the thing that I've been missing. When the camera zooms out and you see the fields of the machines harvesting the energy, that's what can elicit something like that. So operationalizing that and using that is where we've been able to identify a lot of therapeutic benefit from this affect.
We're going to get more into that. When we come back in part two, the first question I want to ask you is, what was a piece of content that did that for you? Whether it was a book or a movie or a song or whatever it was, because I know we can get it from all of them. But before we do that, before we come back to part two, please tell people where they can find out more about you and your work and all the resources.
Great. You can search online for Institute for Advanced Consciousness Studies or go on advancedconsciousness.org. And on our website, you'll be able to see all of our current projects, our proceedings, so links to journal publications. You can get PDFs of them there. And then you can also find all the places to follow us on social media, where we try and translate some of our more scientific focused findings into lay friendly blogs and printing. So our website's the best spot, advancedconsciousness.org.
Well, we'll make sure that all the links are published in the show notes. So if you didn't catch them, don't worry. Just go to the show notes. They'll be right there. We're going to be back in just one click for more of our delicious conversation. Professor Nico, he's going to give us some things to really think about, some things to deeply ponder, and maybe send some shivers down your spine. We're going to be back in one click. Stay curious, my friends. Stay curious. Welcome back to part two of our delicious conversation with Professor Nico Regente. He is a research director at the Institute for Advanced Consciousness Studies, a nonprofit dedicated to democratizing non-ordinary states of consciousness. Part one was delicious. I promise you, if you missed part one and you just happen to land on part two, just go back one in the podcast stream and you'll find it. Honestly, you're going to find it really fascinating, really looking at how we normally think, what happens when we don't think normally, what part of our brain naturally wants to make things normal and predictive. But there's something else going on inside of us that wants something more. And what is that? And is that a spiritual experience? That's something we haven't gotten into yet. Is there a compulsion within us to find something that is deeper? I think there is. Maybe Nico thinks of something different. But before we do that, where we finished in part one was talking about how content, meaning a movie or a TV show or a book or a song or whatever it is, can sort of catalyze these non-ordinary states within us. And I was talking about how the Matrix did that for a lot of people. I want to know from you, Nico, was there a piece of content that really did that for you?
Yeah, it's hard to say because I feel like there's not been just one, but many.
No, I'm sure there's been many. I got many too.
Yeah. But the most potent elicitor for me typically is with music, especially in a live setting. And some of the peak ones I can think about are actually from Radiohead and their song Reckoner off of In Rainbows, which is one of my favorite albums of all time. And something about hearing that live with a collection of people all kind of dissolving almost into one and having this deep appreciation and recognition of, I want to say that there's some weighing of the heart, let's say, that comes at the end of our time here. And that's what I take Reckoner, that song, to be about. And it's almost like this recognition. This is something that's, you know, you see it in Egyptians, right? The weighing of the heart. There's a whole host of talk around this in Bardo texts. So it was just this remembering, and especially in a collective setting, a remembering of the ephemerality of our lives and our mortality, but then also potentially some connection to a progression past this one as a function of our deeds here. And something about Reckoner really hit that for me, and it really helped impact the way that I like to live my life.
So that's a spiritual experience for you.
Oh yeah, most certainly.
That is beyond the physical and beyond, not just the physical as in non-ordinary state, but beyond the physical experience of being in the body, of being somewhere else. I've used this analogy before because I'm old. You bought Hotel California back in the day, one of the best-selling albums of all time, and it was a fantastic album. You loved the album. And then you went to see the Eagles play live, and they played Hotel California, and it was a completely different experience. Heart Math Institute research, the collective of all that heart resonance, everybody in resonance with each other, in resonance with the music, in resonance, and this is internal, external, in resonance with what that album evoked within you. So again, an aesthetic state that it evoked within you that now is being shared, and then this collaborative mush of everybody's resonance coming together around this song, creating idolization. I mean, there's a whole other piece around this that I talk about, which is how do you create a cult and an idolization by creating resonance at a heart level, at a consciousness level. This is why a lot of cults use non-ordinary states, because there's a resonance with that. And it's like, nobody else gets us. Well, that's true. They don't. It doesn't mean it's good, but it does mean that there's a resonance there. And so I really understand what you're saying about seeing that song live, being in resonance with everybody. But then there's that extra piece, which you talk about here, which is the internalization of the reckoning of one's own life. And now how am I assessing my life? And who have I been, and what am I, and what is the reckoning at the end, the weight of my heart, the weight of my deeds? That's really fascinating. Do you think, though, that our listener, the average C-suite individual, goes there? Or do you think they go there and it's quiet and it's something they don't talk about? Or do you think that they just don't go there because they're caught in the hustle?
It's a great question. Yeah. I think a lot of it's hidden in plain view. And it's just a matter of whether or not you can be cognizant of it in the first place. So let's take a step back and see what you were describing around the Eagles and Hotel California, and it, or my Radiohead experience, is this notion of a collective effervescence. That's kind of a term to describe this. And really a big part of what's happening there, which is something that I really initially appreciated in choirs. So I've been in choir since I was a kid. And something that I really appreciated there that also happens in large stadiums or even smaller shows where everybody's singing along, there's this remarkable phenomenon of losing yourself to the crowd, even though you are a part of it and making. So this happens often for the average listener. Let's say, look at these large football stadiums. That's actually a place where chills are quite frequent because there's unitary focus on one collective objective. You see it quite literally with the wave, right? People making the wave. It's this collective act that you're participating in that is strangely, well, if you didn't participate, it wouldn't make a difference necessarily. But if everybody thought that, then there would be no thing. So there's this interesting balance happening between your contribution to the thing and how much that contribution matters. But the point is that, and much like in a choir, your act is not solo. It's part of something together. So this actually can help promote a feeling of self-transcendence, which comes along with ego dissolution. You are no longer just the act of expressing your own internal will. So you start to lose a little bit of this autonoetic consciousness, or this consciousness as we know it, ego-based consciousness. And there permits for a period where you transcend the self, which, kind of going back to the first episode, that's almost the greatest unforgetting, or Plato's anamnesis. It's the forgetting of the ego. So you're forgetting the ego and remembering the collective source. So in having a self-transcendent experience where your ego dissolving, which can be encouraged by these states of collective effervescence or doing things at the same time collectively, that can promote this feeling of self-transcendence. And I think that that's actually quite common.
I think you're right. It is quite common. But as a pushback on the other side of that is this collective consciousness, this collective effervescence you talk about, that certainly can be used, for instance, polarized politics. You go to the rally and you're a reasonably moderate person at that rally. You're suddenly finding yourself screaming and shouting things that you might not have screamed and shouted and may walk away from. I've talked a lot about, written a lot about what I call the good Germans, and the good Germans who lived in Germany during World War, or beginning of World War II, the rise of the Nazis, the rise of the fascists, who were just good people and then were washed away in that and certainly regretted it later. I'm not saying different, but there is that collective effervescence that you can get washed away in, and it is beyond your cognitive process or even beyond your rational ego into this collective consciousness, which is not necessarily good. And so that's the other side of it.
Yeah, I think that's a really astute point and one to be careful of, because if we go back to this, you know, active inference model, right, there's safety in the herd. There's safety in numbers. And if we seek comfort and accordance of our model with other people having models, then we're going to kind of gravitate to the ones that produce the least friction with our own. You raise a great point, because the whole opposite side of all of this, there is a darker side, which is brainwashing. A lot of terrorist organizations actually use chills evoking content on their recruits, because there's something there. There's this feeling as though you're dissolving your ego, you're having self-transcendence. The promotion of martyrdom is that you are more than the sum of your parts and you're promoting a higher good. There's a lot of potential for negativity. And you also see that on the opposite side of the spectrum with horror chills, another very common phenomenon, same type of process, but you're receiving it from a horror experience. And in that case, we kind of think about it as the opposite side. Most of the time we go around and our world models are pretty accurate. And when they're super right and on the point is when we feel these pleasurable aesthetic chills. But when we're maximally wrong, I think is when we feel the horror chill. So you can imagine some type of horror film where something comes on the screen and it's like, I don't have a model for whatever that is that I just saw. It doesn't make sense. There's so much error. I was maximally surprised. So we think that when you're maximally wrong in the case of horror chills, or maximally right in the case of aesthetic chills, that's when you actually have this mass propagation of belief updating to the system, and it's felt in the same way, but it's either negatively or positively balanced.
Do you?
Yeah.
And the reason I say do you is because a lot of people, it's too much. So they cannot see what's happening to children in Gaza, for instance. It's just too horrific. It's too horrific for most people, but it's too horrific. And it becomes a conspiracy. That's not real. That's fake. And that's really validating my belief system. I've got to stick with this because it's familiar, because I know it. That aesthetic horror that should awaken me is not awakening me. Again, like the good Germans.
Yeah, that's a brilliant point, and something that really matters around integration with all good trips. And this is actually something that Adam Saffron, who introduced us,
yeah,
he adds some important nuance and complexity to this same issue in psychedelics. There's this whole notion that psychedelics work by relaxing beliefs and now you can see things in a new light. Well, it could actually be the case that in some cases they strengthen belief, depending on doses, depending on context, depending on integration. I actually take that to heart and say, we need to be thinking of things in the same way. And perhaps some of the language I've been using thus far around the potential for chills to update beliefs is not as nuanced as it should be. I totally appreciate your point. There's definitely cases where, depending on the rigidity of your pre-existing beliefs and the context, that certain cases could actually help to strengthen beliefs. And the atrocity currently in Gaza can kind of go both ways. Like, you could think like, oh, Israel is one type of way, and this is more evidence mounting to it. Or you could say, oh, this is a whole propaganda machine and we're being lied to by Hamas to convey doubt. It's very complicated. And it depends on A, how much information you're digesting and what your pre-existing beliefs are and what your community structure is like, what the culture you're situated in, whether or not your beliefs resonate with the culture or not. So there's a whole host of nuance here that I'm really grateful for bringing to the surface.
As you talked about, there's also the tribal effect, meaning if I have this experience that awakens to something, but I'm living in a tribe, I live in the milieu of a certain set of belief systems. Let's say I'm living in a very conservative part of America that's very pro-Israel and very Christian nationalist, and I suddenly have this awakening, I can't speak that awakening in that environment. So I've got to repress it and shut it down, or I got to get the hell out. And if I get the hell out, now I have to leave my tribe behind, and his mom, his dad, and my siblings, or my family, or whatever it might be. I believe, this is my belief, it's not the truth. I think there's some truth in it. This is my bias. The enlightenment is a destructive process. It's a totally destructive process. It must break down what you had in order to have something else. In order to get to that larger place, you have to break out of the place you are in. And even though that place you are in may be palatial and wonderful to every sense you have right now, and that's the turmoil within. I want to break out. I want to experience more. I've got a Rolls Royce. I've got another house. I've got all these goodies and I've got all the status, but I know there's something more. But if I go to that, am I going to lose this? And the answer is yes. Not on a permanent basis, but you'll lose the meaning of it and you'll gain something deeper. But losing that meaning, this is what we're so attached to, because that meaning piles into the identity we talked about in part one. And I built this meaning to survive that lunatic asylum called my childhood. So even though I cognitively know I'm no longer seven, I might be 70, but my belief system structure is still like, that shit could happen again, so better hold on. It's really fascinating work you're doing. That's why I want to take it into the studies and where those took you and what those showed you.
I'd love to, yeah. The enlightenment as destruction, yeah. It really resonates with Siddhartha's story, like coming up in riches and abandoning. You make a good point around politics here, because we actually just put out a paper, just came out a couple of days ago, on the relationship between political orientation and interoceptive awareness. Interoceptive awareness being like, how aware are you of internal bodily sensations? Can you feel your heartbeat? Can you feel hunger and chills? So we actually found this really interesting finding that we saw a little hint of it in another study. We saw that liberals were getting chills more often. The occurrence of chills was more often than liberals, people who declare themselves liberals. However, the chills intensity wasn't terribly high. On the opposite side, conservatives got chills far less often. But when they got chills, it was far more intense. The chills intensity was higher. We were kind of operating from this perspective of saying, oh, wait, so maybe conservatives have more rigid belief structures, and for them to get chills is harder to dismantle those belief structures. They're more rigid. But when you do break through, the trumpets breaking down the walls, it's a big deal. Whereas liberals, they're connecting more dots more regularly. So they see the connection between things. Their world models are potentially larger. So it's like, oh yeah, well, I've kind of thought about it before. You're more likely to get chills and connect these dots, but they're less intense because more regular. At least that was our notion going in. And when we did a more closely examined follow-up study in a cohort of conservatives and liberals in both California and Texas to kind of get to the context effect, we saw that actually what's driving the effects we saw before were from extremism. So it's actually more of a U-shaped, where there's extremes on both sides, extremely liberal, extremely conservative. And it's those rigids that are actually almost entirely mediated by interoceptive awareness. And that's like being aware of whether you can feel your heart or your stomach, et cetera. And that's actually the people that get the more intense chills, which is also an interoceptive process. And the way we understood it is that the way that people go to extreme is by being, in this case, a negative way, more in touch with their body or having more bodily oriented responses. So for instance, if something like a trans individual elicits disgust in you and your body feels strange about that, you're going to then go on and have more rigid beliefs around the way in which that population should be governed. Then if it doesn't necessarily elicit that in you, then you can operate more cognitively and try and understand their struggle and et cetera. And anyway, we were able to kind of suss all of this out just based on whether or not people were getting chilled to specific pieces of content. So it's very revelatory, and it also scales with religiosity as well, the degree to which you're religious. So a lot of cool work on there. So I'd love to point listeners there. We can link it or something. What I really want to get into, right, is the therapeutic aspect of chills, big part of what we've been leaning towards. So thus far, we've kind of talked a bit about why chills would come about and how they can be used to identify these potentially maladaptive beliefs, why you respond to one and I don't respond to another. So now, how can we leverage the actual experience of chills to orient people to these maladaptive beliefs and provide them with some type of positive affect that promotes their well-being? So let's look at that from a couple. So in some of our work, what we've done is actually take people with depressive schemas, either shame or negativity schemas, and based on our machine learning analysis from the past, find the pieces of content that most directly to that. And we worked with depressed populations. Basically, like the way we do it is we find in these earlier studies, we found videos that have, based on the population we're looking at, a 50% likelihood of inducing, so that we could end up with two groups, both having watched the same exact content, one gets chills, one doesn't. And then what we saw was that just by watching a 4-minute video, the people who got chills went on to have very potent deactivations of those schemas and a reduction in their depression severity, oftentimes below the clinically defined threshold for depression.
Wow.
From a one-shot intervention. And if you were to read some of the testimonials that people give after taking part in this experience, it's actually very moving. They're talking about the way in which they felt seen and understood, their past struggles, and they're now motivated to take action and change, which is a big part of the integration and a big part of the chills, is that it usually motivates behavior. So we've seen that in acute settings. We've also seen it in more longitudinal settings where we give people chills 5 times over the course of a week, and then we follow up with them 2 months later. And the more chills you got, the more antidepressant effect you get. And that's 2 months in the future from just a few pieces of intervention with this highly specific concept. And now what we've been doing is going even deeper and further and making it hyper-personalized. So we'll go in and match you to the right piece of content that's maximally likely to induce chills in you. But then we'll go in with generative AI and slightly edit the speech that's in there. So typically these are speeches set to music, the ones we're using. We'll slightly edit the speech so that it hyper, and what we call schema surgery, permits for you to confront and resolve your constellation of in a hyper-targeted way. And when we give people chills in this way, it's super therapeutic at long time scales on basically every measure of anxiety and depression that we can look at. It scales long term. We also really put this to the test. This is actually one of my favorite examples. We put this to the test in saying, like, okay, well, that works for insight-based pursuits, and chills are accompanying psychological insight, emotional breakthrough, these types of things that we typically see in psychedelic studies. And we thought, well, can the experience of chills itself actually be therapeutic, even kind of void of some of the semantic? It feels good. It's pleasurable. And we thought a lot of depression research is around ameliorating or muting negative affect. You feel bad, let's make you feel less. We thought, well, what if we try to make people feel more good? Can we just add good to the equation, enhance positive affect instead? So flip the script.
That's one of the things that people talk about, is that they go on antidepressants, they feel numbed down. They're not just feeling less sadness, they're feeling less, period. And what you're talking about is feeling more good.
Yes, exactly. So arguably one of the most, I don't want to use the word disturbing, but the most sad subgroups of depression is anhedonia. So anhedonia, the inability to feel pleasure effectively. So these are individuals that nothing's really moving the needle. And this translates to really terrible behavioral outcomes. If you're not sensitive to pleasure, you're not sensitive to reward. So then you can't do any type of value-based decision making. If you go to these anhedonic patients and you say, hey, in this box is $20, in this box is $5, choose one, they're going to pick either with even likelihood. That's not really setting you up for success in the world. And so we worked with a group of anhedonic patients with Diego Pizzagalli. What we did was we give them what's known as a probabilistic reward task that measures how sensitive they are to reward. And as you'd guess, the anhedonics are abysmal compared to controls. Controls function like how you think. Now, when we find a way to give these patients chills, which requires some of this precision mapping, when we find a way to give them chills, after the chills experience, they're indistinguishable from controls in their capacity to respond to reward. So their hedonic tone has been restored by a peak affective experience like that.
See, that to me is so fascinating, because these are people who would self-identify as, they live in the world of me, nothing really hits them. And so I give you a drug, I give you an opportunity for a reward, I give you an opportunity for sadness, nothing's really going there. And what you're talking about is providing content that does that. That in and of itself seems just as impossible. Because if the drugs are not doing it and the other experiences are not doing it, why does this work becomes the question. Why does this specifically designed schema of content hit where nothing else hits? Do you know that yet?
Yeah, so it starts getting into the weeds of the neurobiology of what's actually happening.
Is it oxytocin? Is it serotonin? Is it dopamine? That's where I would naturally go.
It's a bit more dopaminergic, which kind of goes in line with some of the learning concepts that we've teetered around. Also the reward, it's very similar to the satisfaction phase of the consummatory cycle. It can actually go on and motivate future behavior or cease prior behavior. There's a lot there to really unwind, but it's kind of similar in some cases to promoting capacity for insight in similar ways to ketamine. There's shared mechanisms, especially in like the lateral habenula, the nucleus accumbens, which is why we think it was working so well in these anhedonic patients. And Felix and I put out a paper on the neurobiology of aesthetic chills that we can link to as well that kind of dives into some of this overlap. The idea is it feels good to feel good, right? And that can be therapeutic in and of itself. So, you know, since we've done a whole host of other experiments that try and position chills as maximally similar to other interventions that help promote belief updating. So we've tried to position it on the same landscape as psychedelics, but kind of circling back to the start of the first episode, a big part of our mission and why we got focused on this is that we want to democratize non-ordinary states. And chills, which I think, by the way, is one of the most slept on or underappreciated phenomenons in all of neuroscience. It really hasn't been utilized as much as it should, in my opinion. The idea there was, well, okay, can we both phenomenologically and neurally induce states of consciousness that promote belief updating non-pharmacologically, right? Because psychedelics in the right conditions, right scenarios, can one-shot maladaptive. One trip can really change your life. However, there's a whole host of cultural, social, pharmacological contraindications that prevent people from accessing that state. So it's not as efficient and proliferative as it can be. It's not democratizable. It's not available to everyone. However, something like chills is usually universally recognized. When I talk about chills, people are generally like, oh yeah, cool. Or a lot of times they'll say to me, oh man, I just got goosebumps as you were talking about. I was like, oh yeah, that's the thing we're talking about.
Exactly.
It really helps serve our mission. And a lot of our work has really started to show that. Some of the work championed by one of my same collaborators that did the political chills work also championed this effort, scientist here at the Institute. He did some work that showed that basically the same phenomenology that's evoked in psychedelics, we see in chills when you ask people about the right way. You see measures of self-transcendence with ego dissolution, with social moral elevation, increased transpersonal self, decreased personal self, increased connectedness to others. So those are all the same types of things we see in psychedelics. Same things with psychological insight, emotional breakthrough. And we're talking very similar effect sizes, if not even better in some cases, because you don't necessarily come with the anxious ego dissolution that can come with self-transcendence sometimes in psychedelic trips, especially when you feel like you can't get out of it. And I can link you to some papers showing that chills accompany self-transcendence, emotional breakthrough, psychological insight. And it's actually a big part of what we've been doing to try and what we call emulate entheogens. Entheogens being the word for finding God within. So entheogenic experiences. Many psychedelics can be entheogenic, but the classic ones are like ayahuasca,
yeah,
psilocybin, this notion of finding divinity or finding God within, however you take that term. And so chills kind of came as a big insight, a big pillar in that overarching mission of trying to emulate entheogen. The latter part of it is for enhancing empathy. So we kind of call the project E4 in-house. So some of our most recent work was to say, okay, well, can we use chills to change people's belief schemas around charitable giving or around helping each other or having upticks in empathic concern, which there's a whole many facets of perspective taking and empathy. But really what we cared about was, can you have empathy or can you internalize the affect of another, but then also translate that into concern of taking action to do something about it? Because you can internalize another person's state and not care about it or utilize it and become more Machiavellian, or you can understand it and internalize it and use it to promote good, right? So in the human flourishing.
That's the distinction between empathy and compassion. Empathy, I can feel your feelings. Compassion is I can feel it and I want to help you. I want to do something. It's vastly different. That's the next step. Nico, we are already at the end of part two of the show. And I know there's a lot more that you and I could talk about, and maybe we'll have you come back and we'll do that even as your studies continue. I really want to thank you for being with us, and I hope you'll stay with us to the end, but I want to make sure that you let people know where they can find out more about you. And later on, you can send me all the links to all those things and we'll put those in the show. But for now, just let people know where they can find out more.
Cool. Great. Yeah. You can stay in tune with all of these studies, as well as our latest efforts showing that neurally, it's the same for chills as it is psychedelics. By following us on our website, advancedconsciousness.org, you can find all of our studies there, proceedings, PDFs, lay-friendly blog write-ups, as well as links to all of our social media where we share this information quite regularly, along with the host of other work we're doing at the Institute. But yeah, advancedconsciousness.org, and hopefully some info in the bio or description wherever this is hosted.
Thank you so much, Nico. Stay with us to the end. And for you, dear listener, remember, those who control the meaning for the tribe also control the movement of the tribe. Leaders who are committed to positively shaping the political and business landscape know that they tap into what drives human behavior. I'm Dov Varin. I show businesses, teams, and leaders how to harness their source code to move their tribe, because unified, actualized meaning is a single monolithic difference between mediocrity and greatness for individuals and companies. Remember, we need your help in staying relevant, so please go to wherever it is that you see the show from and do us a favor. Rate, review, and subscribe. And of course, a big thank you to you for sharing the show with everybody you know. It makes a huge difference. We really appreciate it. Till next time, stay curious, my friend. Stay curious about the next time you get those chills, those goosebumps, that ooh, that makes you go, oh, really think about what that was. What is actually happening? You might have just got a full upgrade in your thinking. I'm Dov Barron. I'm here to assist you in tapping into your deepest meaning to reach that next level of clarity, focus, purpose, and profit in your business, in your life, and your leadership impact. And I am out.